Needless to say, you don't play favorites, but every family has a natural unspoken hierarchy. Longest legs up front, shortest kid in the way back, and the one with the best attitude? Right smack dab in the middle. Sorry, buddy. The first ever Lexus TX is a three-row SUV where everybody wins. With loads of elbow room, cargo room, and leg room. For everyone, no matter where they sit. This is a new era of three-row luxury. The Lexus TX. Experience amazing at your Lexus dealer.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart, the seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady, live only on Netflix.
Day.com. From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Imagine if the United States spent as much on foreign aid and development as it did on the Pentagon. What would the world be like? Compared to other wealthy nations, the U.S. is a foreign aid tightwad. But as poverty and disease create new breeding grounds for conflict around the world, could investing money in education and combating AIDS make a bigger difference than increasing the military budget? President Bush is asking for a $48 billion increase in military spending to almost $400 billion on soldiers, guns, and gadgets. The American foreign aid budget has not seen an increase for a decade and totals about $10 billion. At the end of January, the Bush administration rejected an international proposal to double foreign aid, arguing that poor countries should make better use of the funds they already receive. Is foreign aid a worn-out black hole or an investment that America needs to make? Should the United States be pouring more development aid into Africa, Asia, and South America? Would it make the world a safer place? Are guns or butter the better bet? You can join our conversation tonight at 1-800-423-TALK. That's 1-800-423-8255. Joining us in the studio tonight is Jeffrey Sachs. He's director of the Center for International Development at Harvard University, chairman of the Commission on Macroeconomics and Health at the World Health Organization, and just this week has been named Special UN Advisor on Poverty, Health, and Educational Goals. Good evening and welcome, Jeffrey Sachs.
Thanks a lot, Tom. Good to be here.
Good to have you. Also with us in the studio is On Point news analyst Jack Beattie, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom.
Jeffrey Sachs, we're going to work this up one side and down the other, but in a nutshell, what's your quick bottom line? If we took a big slice of money, let's say the almost $50 billion that we're about to add to the Pentagon budget, and instead directed it to foreign aid, would it make a difference? Could it make a difference? Could the system deal with it? Could it profit by it? And if it could, what impact would it have on the world?
Tom, let me take a slightly different take on it. What if we just put aside 10 bucks from each of us, whether it comes out of the military budget or out of consumption of other things? 10 bucks from each of us, if that was done in the United States,
all right,
in Europe, in Japan, that'd be $10 billion. $10 billion would save millions of lives abroad. It would help some of the poorest countries get out of chaos. It's the kind of trade-off that I think people would make if they would be convinced that it would work, that actually the numbers make sense and add up.
So let's step back from it for a second. And first of all, I hear you saying, no, we can't handle $50 billion. Let's start with 10. Is there a limit to how much development aid could productively be deployed right now, this year?
Well, what I'm saying is that some people might say we really need the military spending. I don't want to pit the foreign aid against the military spending necessarily.
And we don't either. Let's just leave the trade-off aside for a second. But we've just shoved our hand deep in our pocket for another $50 billion. We've accepted the idea of deficit spending. President George W. Bush, Republican, has accepted that idea. So if it were another $50 billion or $10 billion, if it weren't a trade-off, still the question stands, is there a limit to how much we could productively put into development aid right now or over the next, you know, X number of years?
In recent years, we just abandoned foreign aid of any sort. Basically, we have no foreign aid program except in name. We have some help for Israel, for Egypt, for a few other countries. We have a pittance here and there. We gave up on that idea almost 20 years ago, actually. The result, I think, has been a disaster. We've left some of the poorest places in the world to collapse, to be unable to confront disease, utter impoverishment. We have contributed to one of the great human tragedies of our times by failing to help countries address the AIDS pandemic. In short, we've abandoned the world stage other than on the military side, even though Americans don't really know that. They think we're still doing a tremendous amount. And by abandoning the world stage, I think we've abandoned our own humanity and our own self-interest.
What did we do then before 20 years ago that we're not doing now?
Well, if you go back half a century ago, we did the Marshall Plan. The Marshall Plan was called by Winston Churchill the most unsordid act in history. He said it was the most remarkable contribution by one country to another part of the world that he could think of in history. What it did was create a democracy and economic health in Europe, and it made a partnership that's lasted for more than half a century.
This is good then. Take us on through that arc, because, of course, those were countries that already had a deep industrial base, though it was badly damaged by the war. What's the arc of development aid, of foreign aid efforts past that? What worked? What didn't? What did we learn? And why did we drop it?
Just in terms of the numbers, the Marshall Plan was about 2% of our gross national product in the first 2 or 3 years of the four-year program.
Compared to now we're spending 0.01?
Now we're spending 0.1, so it was about 20 times the effort, 20
okay.
times. And if we did that today, instead of giving $10 billion, we'd be giving $200 billion, just to try to give it in current numbers. I have to say that while we look back at the Marshall Plan and say, oh, that was a sure thing, that was Europe, there were tremendous skeptics in 1947. Truman went out and campaigned for it, sold the program. It's only in retrospect that it looks obvious. Well, during the 1950s and 1960s, we continued with a fairly generous aid program. It really was the Vietnam War and the whole mess around that and the deep divisions in the country and the sense that we had to pull back from the world that led to a major drop of the foreign aid budget. And then when President Reagan came in, he continued that trend. Aid continued to fall as a share of our national income. What's amazing is that it didn't really matter whether it was Democrats or Republicans in the last 20 years of President Reagan, President Bush, President Clinton, and George W. Just now, all have been on the same page, basically. We're not doing foreign aid. We don't need it. We don't want it. It's not good for America.
But there seems to be layer on layer of illusion and misunderstanding here. As you say, many Americans assume that foreign aid is flowing out there, or that it was or has been. The second thing that always comes up is it's a waste. You pump it out there, if indeed we were even doing it, and it just goes into numbered Swiss bank accounts of Mobutus and other, you know, corrupt dictators in the Third World, or just in the Cold War days, you know, props up those dictators. Has there ever been a period during which foreign aid, as America has practiced it, has really identifiably worked?
Of course, it looks like it's wasted if you don't actually do it, and then you say, where
yes.
are the results?
And, well, and that's was there a time when we were both doing it, and it was demonstrably successful?
Well,
not Marshall Plan, but post-Marshall
right.
Plan.
We do little bits here and there, and sometimes with the most remarkable success. The U.S. contributes to helping children get immunized. The U.S. contributed to the eradication of smallpox. The U.S. is contributing to the eradication of polio right now. These are marvelous successes. It's not that foreign aid doesn't work. It's that we do it in such small doses that we accomplish bits here and there. But we don't really think very much about what would really be needed to address problems that really need to be addressed, whether it's problems that are going to come back and hit us or problems that need to be addressed because we're decent human beings and we'd like to help the poorest people in the world to survive and start making a step forward in their own economic progress.
The rest of the industrialized world gives a much greater portion of their GNP than the U.S. Have their efforts made a difference? The world looks pretty raggedy.
Well, of course, we should note, first of all, that to the shock of Americans, and I've heard reportedly to the surprise of President Bush himself, who didn't quite believe it, the United States ranks last, dead last, on the list of all donor countries, 22nd out of the 22 donor countries in the share of national income that we're giving for foreign assistance. We're down at 0.1. The average in Europe is about 0.3. And in Northern Europe, it's about 0.7 to 1% of GNP. A few countries, the Nordic countries, are giving about 1% of their national income. We're doing about one-tenth of that effort.
So the question stands, with that larger effort on the part of some of our other wealthy neighbors and comrades, is the Third World developing on that foreign aid?
Well, I just finished a two-year project for the World Health Organization involving health and financial experts from all over the world, and we looked in detail at the foreign assistance for health. We found marvelous results in many parts of the world, including, as I already said, the eradication of smallpox and the near elimination of polio. We found great progress in Bangladesh, once called a basket case, now a growing economy. We found great progress in Vietnam. But what we also found, without doubt, is that the overall scale of help that the whole world together is giving is about $6 billion, when what we ought to be giving as a rich world for health is closer to $25 billion, maybe a fourth of what's needed. Is it any surprise when we're doing so little that things aren't working? You can find the pockets of success, but it's no good to say that, well, the anyway is falling apart, therefore aid isn't needed. What you find is that aid works when you make the investment, when you care about it. But if you don't care about it and you give little bits here and there, it's not surprising that there's such a ragged result.
And has anything changed structurally in the way aid could or is being delivered that would or will keep it from going into the black hole, into the Swiss bank account? Is there something in the post-Cold War period that's changed in the way foreign aid is executed?
Of course, there's one huge change that's possible if we want to make it work. We used to give foreign aid to thugs that were on our side of the Cold War struggle. As FDR famously said about Somoza, he's a son of a bitch, but he's our son of a bitch. And we used to give help to those types because they would fight the Soviets. We don't have to do that anymore. We could give aid to children so that they don't die 1 million a year of measles.
You mean bypassing the government somehow?
Well, bypassing the government or just directing it to those governments that are actually undertaking the real development goals. We used to give money even if they weren't doing that because we wanted to keep the thugs on our side. So development assistance can be wasted or it can be used for non-development purposes. My suggestion would be that if we really wanted to help the poorest of the poor, boy, do we know how to do it.
And just break down the numbers for us. It's $10 billion. Where does it go? This is U.S. foreign aid.
Oh, I would say that if we started an increase of $10 billion, the first thing that I'd like to do is directed towards the most urgent needs in human health. Because while it's a cliche to say people live on the edge of survival, what I've seen with my own eyes and what the studies and the numbers all show is people are not living on the edge of survival. They are dying because they're going right over the edge by the millions. We don't have the headlines that say it every day, but you could have a newspaper headline every day that says 25,000 people died today of poverty. And that would be an absolutely solid and rigorous headline. 25,000 per day die because they don't have enough income to get the health or nutrition that they need.
Jack Beatty, our frequent guest on this show, Robert Kaplan, describes the United States as the limousine driving through the Dust Bowl. He says that's not a safe place to be. Yet we've responded to terrorism with a military response, and who can blame the government? There's been a violent threat to the country and the threat that it could be repeated and repeated again. But how do you see this trade-off between military might projection and the potential of projecting dollars and development aid?
I just think we have to rethink the idea of national security. In American politics and in American life, when you say something is national security, it takes on an urgency. It takes on a momentum.
Sure does.
President Eisenhower had to, disguise the interstate highway system under national security. And I think one of the things this crisis has forced us to do and should be forcing us to do is to rethink, recalibrate what national security is. And at the center of it should be consideration of the gap between the rich and the poor in the world and this health crisis, because we are in that limousine and those people are outside. And even if the terrorists themselves seem to have come from comfortable circumstances, everybody, even Colin Powell on Saturday, said the breeding ground of terrorism is poverty, illiteracy, disease. We must address this problem. He said that on Saturday, and on Thursday, the administration said no to a World Bank plan to increase giving by $50 billion. So talk is cheap from this administration, but they're acting just in the other way.
And Jack, I might add, the $50 billion wasn't from the U.S. It was from all the rich world, of which the U.S. part might have been $10 billion. We're talking about maybe one penny out of every $10 of our income that would go towards that kind of increase right now. And we're not even willing to give the one penny out of every $10. Actually, I think the American people are willing to do it. It's the government that's not willing to look closely at the proposition.
If Americans just believed it would work, it would be very interesting to see how they stood up, if they stood up. Listeners, what do you think? What about foreign aid? Do you believe in it? Can it work? Could foreign aid ultimately be more effective than a mighty military arsenal in gaining global security? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight with Jeffrey Sachs, Director of the Center for International Development at Harvard University, about foreign aid and whether it just might be more effective long-term and even pretty darn quick right now than military muscle in creating a more secure world. What do you think? What's the right global mix of guns and butter? Does Washington have the right ratio of smart bombs and global development assistance going on right now? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Jeffrey Sachs, you were just in New York over the weekend at the World Economic Forum.
That's right.
Traditionally held in Davos, Switzerland, famously the haunt of bigwig CEOs and government power brokers. This year, with a much more kind of a socially aware agenda, Bono was there and Bill Gates arguing with Paul O'Neill. Surely this wasn't the first one of these that you've attended. Do you see the world community looking at these issues in a fresh way, or is it the same old, same old?
This was definitely a different World Economic Forum. The recent years have been U.S. triumphalism. This was post-September 11 and the U.S. in recession and Enron and a lot of the world asking all week and weekend, where is the U.S. other than in the military action? Where is the U.S. in the fight against global poverty? Where is the U.S. in understanding the stresses of globalization? And I think U.S. officials, Colin Powell, Paul O'Neill, and others really heard an earful because all through the halls it was ringing, we've got a global AIDS pandemic. We have 40 million people infected with AIDS, and we're not doing anything about it right now. What about it, United States? We have a world of impoverishment and anger. What about it, United States? So it was a very different meeting from past years.
What was the tenor or the substance of the American response?
Oh, the Americans were defending the position, but frankly,
what position?
Well, defending the position that first, of course, our primary objective is to defend freedom through the war against terrorism. But then I think what most of the officials did was say, of course we care about poverty. Of course we care about disease and health. And that's why we're doing something. But that's where the smoke and mirrors come in, because it's really easy to say we're doing things, and indeed there are 100 very small programs. The question is the scale of the effort. The question is how much we're really giving and whether we're giving enough to face the problems. And the answer is no, but we still defend it because Americans tend to believe, even these officials may believe, that we're doing a tremendous amount when it just doesn't add up.
Jack Beatty, what was the exchange between Bono and was it Paul O'Neill that you heard?
Yeah, Jeff can probably give it from memory. Do you want me to quote it exactly?
For it, Jack.
Paul O'Neill said, the question is, how do we create a situation so that people become engines of economic progress and not just objects of pity? And Bono retorted to that, dead people don't make a great workforce.
They sure don't. Jeff Sachs, Jack Beatty, stand by. We're joined right now by Ben Barber. He's author of Jihad versus Macworld and distinguished professor of political science at the University of Maryland. Ben Barber, good evening and welcome.
Hi, how y'all doing?
We're fine, thanks. You were in New York as well over the weekend. What did you see stirring at the World Economic Forum, Ben Barber, that may not be stirring on Capitol Hill or in the White House?
Well, I think Jeff gave a good description of it. I think most of the world that was there, including a great many corporate CEOs, were anxious, to put it mildly, and maybe panicked, to put it a little more aggressively, about the state of the world, the instability of the world economy and globalization, and the threats that the anarchy of global terrorism brings. And I think people are beginning to see there may be some connection between the anarchy that promotes global terrorism and the anarchy that promotes global markets.
So is foreign aid the answer, Ben Barber? Is that the key?
It's one piece of the answer. I mean, you know, I'm always amused because when it comes to the military side, when it comes to prisons, you know, people don't have problems throwing money at these issues. But when it comes to education in the United States and health abroad and foreign aid, suddenly we get out the accountants and the looking glass and start to, and the microscopes and start saying, oh, we just wasted 75 cents here. Let's end the program. You know, one rather cynical way to look at it is that if you want to see what a country really cares about, see what it's willing to waste a little money on. Because we've wasted an incredible amount of money on intelligence operations in the military and defense spending and missile defense over the last 10 or 15 years. We'd be willing to waste a little and maybe squander a little money inefficiently to get some real impact. I mean, when people say, you know, we've spent money and there's no efficient outcome, what we need to do is spend more of that. If something's going to be wasted, that means more has to be put in, not less. Obviously, we want to spend it well and efficiently. Obviously, there has to be accountability. But the excuses we use in order to not give aid are excuses that vanish when it comes to military spending.
But Ben Barber, it brings to mind Jesse Helms' comment about how money to the U.N. was money down a rat hole. Isn't that kind of the deep suspicion that many Americans have that keep them from punching the button that says, let's spend it?
Sure they do. But what's odd is that when we spend $30 billion on intelligence and nobody can tell us what's coming on 9/11, you know, everyone says, gee, maybe we better spend $60 billion this time. Nobody says, gee, let's strip the budget from them. When we spend billions on missile defense and you can't hit one damn missile coming in from outer space, you know, people say, let's spend some more till we get it right.
Ben Barber, we know we just got you for a minute. Last question. If the United States doesn't step up and spend development dollars, what will the consequences be in your view?
Well, I think it's easy to say every time we fail to educate a young man, they'll be at a Taliban school learning hate. Every time we don't create a citizen, we're going to create a rebel, a revolutionary, and a terrorist. It's a lot cheaper to educate citizens than to fight terror. And if we start doing some preventative medicine in the world economy and around issues of world justice, we may find we can spend a whole lot less down the line in trying to take on the terrorists when it's too late to deal with the causes.
Ben Barber, thanks for stopping off in the airport terminal to join us tonight. Come to Boston sometime and talk with us.
Okay.
Ben Barber is author of Jihad versus Macworld. He's Distinguished Professor of Political Science at the University of Maryland. Jeff Sachs, there's a dire prediction. Take a couple more minutes and connect the dots for us so that we really understand how poverty and disease, in your view, end up breeding global insecurity of the kind that may actually threaten American families, children's, people in the street?
Well, let me make an observation, not my view, but the CIA's view. The CIA has been sponsoring what they call the Task Force on State Failure for the last 5 years, which is a major study to try to understand why places collapse, why you get the Afghanistans and the Somalias. They found that three variables, the three things, were the best predictors of collapse. One was an authoritarian government, so democracy really is more stable. Second was a closed economy and society, so being connected to the world really is more stable. But the third is a high disease burden. It turns out that infant mortality rates are one of the key predictors of future collapse of states, and it's disease itself obviously destroys human well-being and destroys economic capacity, but it also deeply undermines social order. And so if we want to address the root causes of instability abroad, yes, we do have to think about economy, we do have to think about democracy, but we also have to think about disease, health, and the root conditions, the basic needs of people.
Mm. Jeff Sachs, stand by. Seda is on the line. Welcome, Seda. You're on the air.
Hi.
Good evening.
Thanks for having me.
Sure.
I work for an organization called Management Sciences for Health. We're in Boston and D.C. and around the world in about 10 different countries.
Okay, what do you do?
I do finance work. As an organization, we do public health work.
Okay.
We do management consulting mostly. We work with ministries of health, hospitals, other NGOs, non-government organizations, et cetera.
So from where you sit, could the system handle some more dollars poured into it? Could they be effectively deployed, Seda?
Absolutely. Let me make a couple points. The first thing is it's imperative for the U.S. as a leader of this world to increase foreign aid, to take better care of the people of this world, especially for the security of our country. If you read the mission statement from U.S., the United States Agency for International Development, it goes on and on about how the economic security, the military security, all the security of this country depends on the well-being of the nations around us, particularly those in developing nations where they're poverty-stricken, they're disease-stricken, et cetera.
Okay.
And, you know, this is a mission statement. This is a U.S. government organization.
Yeah, but the USAID is hardly the leading agency of the U.S. government in recent years.
Absolutely. And I think that there's something going wrong over there. I think that we need to further educate our government officials, whether it's our state reps, you know, our Senate representatives, et cetera. There's something missing there. There's, you know, in my line of work, we've seen very little money go a long, long way. We, MSH, implemented a program in Bangladesh for about 10 years, and it cost us very, very little money, and the impact that it had on the country was amazing. The average birth rate, I believe, per woman in the country was 12, and it dropped to 7. Mm. That's incredible. Mm. And this was 10 years of work with very limited funding. We were able to do a lot.
Seda, thanks for your report from the front line. We're grateful for it. Jeff Sachs, make this concrete for us. If the money was poured in, and you pick a figure, whether it's the $20 billion total or $50 billion globally, whatever it is, what flowers would grow in that garden? What difference would it make that we could understand and perceive, feel?
Of course, I think different places in the world have different problems. But if you look at the poorest of the poor, mostly in Africa, but in some other places in the world as well, the most horrendous issues are those of life and death, lack of access to basic health, diseases like AIDS and malaria and tuberculosis running out of control, hunger and lack of schooling. It's interesting, by the way, as Seda pointed out, the USAID mission statement, President Bush says almost on a weekly basis exactly the same thing, that unless every child in the world has health and education, we won't win the war against terror. The problem is not the rhetoric. The problem is the disconnect between the rhetoric and the reality of what we're doing. It's so easy to make these statements, but it seems so hard to connect the dots. Our health commission for WHO spent 2 years making detailed calculations. We found that to really fight the disease epidemic worldwide, you'd need $25 billion. Maybe the U.S. share each year, the U.S. share might be around $10 billion. That would translate by the most serious epidemiological studies that have ever been done, and they were done as part of this worldwide network in this project, that would save about 8 million people per year who are dying of their poverty, in essence. That's the 25,000 per day that we don't read about in the news.
Jack Beatty, if Jeff Sachs is right, that it could all be changed in this way, and if it's that clear, what do you think it is in the American political reality that keeps us from flipping that switch? There's not a murmur of protest against the $50 billion additional, or scarcely a murmur for defense, and Lord knows there's a proven need for defense here. But what about another $10 billion, another $20 out of $400 billion to the Pentagon for foreign aid? Why is it so darned hard?
Demagoguery is the short answer, and decades of it. Polls have shown if you ask Americans what percentage of our budget do we spend on foreign aid, they say 15%. It's, what is it? Is it 1%?
It's a half of 1%.
Half of 1%.
But leave aside idealism even, just at a pragmatic level. Are pragmatic. If you tell me I can lay down that $10 bill and I can fix a $1,000 problem, I'm there.
Well, let's have the politician step up and say it. And I think people are ready for that kind of change. But I want to just board another train of thought for a minute. You know, you say our government has stopped aid pretty much in the last 20 years, but we have been doing something else. And that something else is a regime that some people call market fundamentalism under the IMF and the World Bank. And the hypothesis is that that hasn't worked. And the examples, I can give you statistics of how Latin America, Africa, and in other countries have just, continents have just gone down in the last 40 years.
Globalization by another word.
Globalization by another name. That this is an ahistorical formula for development, that historically development, the greatest success story in development is this country. As late as 1915, we had a 33% tariff on imported goods. We had a protected domestic market. We had a managed currency, all the rest. In the 20th century, after the Second World War, the dramatic gains for development in Asia were from countries, Japan, Korea, Southeast Asia, Taiwan, and so on, who had protection, who had managed trade, who had protected currencies. And the big success stories today in China, Vietnam, all have had either in the past or now protected currency, protected markets, and so on. And yet, the IMF and the World Bank says to countries at the bottom, oh, no, you can't protect any part of your agriculture. You can't protect your public sector. You can't intervene in your market. You've got to be open for laissez-faire capitalism. Well, there's no model, is there, Jeff, that has ever been the path to development for countries?
Jeff Sachs?
I think there are actually two parts to look at. First was the idea that economic reform by itself without any help would be its own reward. That was, in my view, the biggest crime of this last 20 years. The idea, we don't have to help you. You just tighten your belt. You just do what we're told. There's not going to be foreign aid. There's not going to be debt relief. You're going to structurally adjust as the line went. That, I think, was the absolutely shocking and profound failure. I've often said that the role of the IMF during that 20-year period from 1980 to 2000 was basically to keep the barbarians away from the U.S. taxpayer, because the poor countries would come to the U.S. and say, we need help, we need help, our people are dying. And the U.S. would say, well, go to the IMF, they'll help you. And the IMF would say, tighten your belt more.
So it was all bootstraps, in other words.
It was all bootstraps, and it was precisely, we're not going to give you help. Then came the specifics of the recommendations. And I have had my differences also with the recommendations. I do believe that for poor countries to make it, they do have to hook up to the world economy, but they have to do it in a clever way. I don't believe in isolating the economies. I do believe that actually attracting foreign investment, if you're lucky enough to be able to do it, has been critically helpful. For instance, China has been essentially an export machine where foreign investors go in, they invest in the coast. China's become one of the great export powers over a period of 20 years, and that's what carried the fastest economic growth in the whole world in modern history, actually, for China. So the question is, how do you properly hook up to the world economy? The IMF hasn't gotten that right.
But what about Jack's point that a lot of these countries, our own included, at one time developed very quickly behind tariff walls?
It depends on the scale of the market. If you have a continental-wide country, you have a large market. If you're Burkina Faso, there is nothing behind your tariff wall.
Well, but Japan was not continent-wide.
And Japan is 120 million people. It's one of the most populous countries in the world. And Japan actually developed after – this goes back to textbook history, but from 1868 until 1900, which was the initial industrialization of Japan, it was under free trade. The reason it was under free trade is there was forced free trade by the imperial powers and by the United States in the so-called unequal treaties.
But you're not buying Jack's suggestion that tapping into the global economy can be a kind of poison for developing nations.
I'm not buying it exactly, because I think everything needs to be disentangled. I think what Jack says, that the strategy that's been put on offer has been a massive failure, I agree with completely. But I just want to go a little bit more carefully into two aspects of it. That is recommendations without help were bound to fail without the aid. And that was the real purpose of that whole era. Stay away from our taxpayers. Secondly, the specific tactics that they recommended for many reasons were misguided.
We'll come back to that. We're talking with Jeffrey Sachs about foreign aid. What do you think? Could foreign aid ultimately be more effective than military might in gaining global security? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Would you be willing to put a few dollars more toward development aid abroad? I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about guns and butter. Do we have the right mix in the post-9/11 era? Is our response to terror aware enough of the development needs of the world? We've got unmanned fighter planes, destroyers, and new aircraft carriers. We've got a lot of military hardware coming down the pike. But what about the foreign aid complement? Is it large enough? Is it sufficient? Do we have the right ratio here? And if we don't make it bigger, do we have a chance of a peaceful world for that military to someday be stood down in? We're joined tonight by Jeffrey Sachs. He's director of the Center for International Development at Harvard University. And there are a lot of calls who want to come in, but I want to just close the loop, Jeffrey Sachs, first on Jack Beatty's point. What about the IMF? You began talking about it. We've come to think that they are the arbiter of how this all ultimately flows together. That's the markets and development efforts of third world countries and foreign aid. Do they have the recipe right here? If we pour foreign aid in, and the fundamental expectations of these countries are set incorrectly somehow, well, nothing's going to come out anyway.
Development has two parts. One is the health and education, because if you don't have healthy and educated people, you can give up on the rest of development. The other is the business plan to generate business, economic growth, and investment. The IMF was wrong on both of them. It squeezed the country so much that people literally have died by the millions for lack of access to health. And the education systems, as it were, in Africa and other poor countries are in absolute disarray. On the business strategy, ironically, the IMF also got it wrong, because they think like textbook, not like business. So they ran Africa, in effect, for 20 years. They ran dozens of countries telling them what to do. But 20 years later, Africa still is as dependent on coffee and cocoa and sisal and rubber and palm and so forth.
Raw materials.
Without getting into manufacturers, technology. And that's because the IMF did not have a strategy to help Africa to attract the kind of new industry and services that it needs to escape from the dependence on those primary commodities. In other words, no good business plan.
So what's to give us confidence that that will be different going forward?
Well, the first thing is that we've got to get to the health and education, and that is a matter of dollars.
All right, granted,
and cents.
That takes dollars and that takes aid, but the point of doing that is then to give those people productive lives.
Well, whether the IMF will do better, I think the best thing we have going for it is 20 years of its failure, that it has new direction and a recognition that it didn't work, and at least from what I'm seeing, the hope that it can be pushed in a new direction. Where it's being pushed now is from the countries themselves that say, look, you told us for 20 years, now we want to do our own strategy. And I'm seeing a lot of sensible things from the poorest countries in terms of real business strategy. Countries are saying to me, look, we need to give the right tax incentives to get in those industries. The IMF's telling us no. What do you think? And what I'm saying and what I'm seeing is much more sensible approaches. So I think actually we could make a lot of headway on the latter. I have to say, though, that my sense of the urgent priorities, though, are that we have millions and millions of people dying right now that do not need to die. And if the American people would see that and get it traced out for them a bit, they would be shocked. They would not want to live in a world where we're letting people die the way we are letting them die.
Let's bring callers into this conversation. A lot of them are waiting to join. Roy is on the line. Welcome, Roy. You're on the air.
Great discussion.
Thank you.
Jack said a little earlier that we need to completely rethink what we mean by national security, and I couldn't agree more. I think we also need to recognize that that by skimping on foreign aid, we're having more effects on our national security than just breeding despair and terrorism.
How so, Roy? How do you see that?
Specifically about AIDS, for example.
Okay.
We worried a lot since 9/11 about terrorists in some shadowy lab who may be genetically engineering some new disease.
Yes.
And the greatest engineer out there is still evolution. AIDS all by itself loves to mutate. And in Africa, I look at Africa and I see a continent-wide genetic engineering laboratory generating new forms of AIDS, and if it should ever come up with one that's 2 times or 10 times easier to transmit than what we've got now, we might look back at this time and think that Al-Qaeda was the good old days.
Roy, thanks for this thought, and let's put it to Jeffrey Sachs. Jeffrey Sachs, I know you've looked at AIDS a lot. I want to talk about this in really blunt terms. I think, and this is a horrible thought, but I think there are some people who think, well, the population will be smaller. It might ultimately help Africa develop. I mean, it's a grotesque way of looking at it in moral terms. But how does the AIDS epidemic actually roll out across Africa? For what consequences for the world?
Let me try to describe a bit of the most horrendous situation disease that we've seen since the Black Death, the plague of 1348, and perhaps it'll be the greatest in all of history. 65 million people so far have been infected with the HIV virus, which causes AIDS. 25 million have died. 40 million are living with the disease, overwhelmingly in the poorest countries, and Africa is the epicenter. Despite the fact that 65 million people have been infected, the United States has not gotten one single human being in the entire world on antiretiral treatment to this point.
In the entire developing world.
In the United States, yes, we have a massive program for our own citizens. But in the poor countries, there is not one individual in the poor countries that is on antiretroviral treatment to keep them alive as a result of U.S. assistance or, by that matter, any other donor. It's unbelievable, actually, when we look back. Now, a couple weeks ago, I was in Africa, actually traveling with Bono to try to see what the real situation on the ground. It was so much more dramatic than even a few months before, even than a year or two before. And if I could just take a minute to paint the picture, we went to Queen Elizabeth Hospital in Malawi, one of the poorest countries in the world. The hospital is an AIDS ward, but there are no drugs in the AIDS ward. So the room was three dying people to a bed. It's almost impossible to imagine. Two dying within the bed, one underneath the bed, literally on the floor, a room of hundreds of people all dying because there are no meds there. And then, incredibly, across the hall was the outpatient clinic where the few Malawians that could afford the $1 a day to keep themselves alive were effectively staying alive and staying healthy and returning to their work and to their families because these drugs really work. So this was a case of people dying by the thousands in front of your eyes, not because there wasn't infrastructure or hospital or doctors, because there was no money to buy even a dollar a day to keep the mothers and the fathers, the doctors and the nurses, the farmers alive. We went out to the village very quickly. It's like an orphanage. There were grandmothers whose four or five or six children had all died of AIDS, and the grandmothers, these wizened, old, tragic ladies, were watching 15 wards now, 15 of their grandchildren, because all of the children were gone. We didn't see anyone of working age population.
All right. Our time is growing short, but I want to ask you this. Americans may not know with this acuity how badly it is, but they know it's bad. And the foreign aid still isn't there. If people choose to be blind, events can still come and ultimately wake them up. Draw the picture. For the Africans, the consequences of this are unbelievable suffering and death. What will the consequences for the United States be if this goes unchecked?
Well, I think Roy put his finger on it, didn't he? One, the mutations of AIDS?
Come back and visit us genetic or biologically.
You know, we speculate that maybe a disease is going to arise in Africa that would spread to the world. But that's exactly what's happened with AIDS.
There it is.
This was a disease that started in West Africa with a few cases and now 65 million around the world, every country, including almost a million in the United States, have been infected with this. Suppose that Africa had a health system that had been able to catch this much earlier, identify the virus decades before. Who knows how much suffering and death we could have headed off? But we don't even ask that question, it seems. We've got multi-drug-resistant tuberculosis spilling over borders. Roy is absolutely right on a pure biological sense, not to mention the social and the economic and the security implications. The epidemiologists are telling us that 40 million children are likely to be orphaned by the year 2010. And imagine what kind of societies that's going to create with 40 million orphans growing up without parents' education guidance in these impoverished places.
And, you know, the hard, honest fact is that makes September 11th look very, very small, as awful as it was. Jeffrey Sachs, thanks very much for joining us tonight. It's great to have you on.
Oh, it's great to be with you.
Jeffrey Sachs is director of the Center for International Development at Harvard University, chairman of the Commission on Macroeconomics and Health at the World Health Organization, and was recently named Special UN Advisor on Poverty, Health, and Educational Goals. Jack Beatty, is that a stark enough picture to shake a few more shekels out of American pockets?
I hope so. In his Nobel speech, Alexander Solzhenitsyn said that the ethical challenge before mankind is to generalize the feeling we have for our family to the world. And for many of us, it just stops with our family. And that's not good enough in a globalizing world. We have to generalize. We have to see the we of me.
There's no bomb smart enough to cure AIDS. Listeners, for ongoing coverage of the day's events, go to our website, onpointradio.org. Jack, thanks for being with us tonight.
Thank you.
We asked you about the music you've turned to since the events of September 11th, and since, we've been broadcasting back some of our favorites. Rob Astick of Salem, Massachusetts, found the Paul Robeson song, "The House I Live In," represented his vision of America and its sources of strength.
What is America to me? A name, a map of a flag I see.
Where God Bless America looks at America as an overall thing, the house I live in looks at the building blocks of it, what makes the country great, what makes it the place that we know and we love.
The house I live in, the friends that I have found, the folks beyond the railroad, and the people all around, the worker and the farmer, the sailor on the sea, the men who built this country, that's America to me.
The lyrics about the people, the citations of what things about America make it special, soapbox, the individual freedoms, these individual details of what make America what it is, stand out in that song, and they're given prominence there, a prominence that you don't hear in a lot of other songs about the country.
Our Gettysburg and Midway and the story of the town, the house I live in, my neighbors white and black, the people who just came here or from generations back.
What drew me to it, on September 12th, one of my co-workers came in that day and was just full of anger at this thing, as was I. And he came in and said, wherever the people who did this lived, I want to bomb them. I don't care what happens. I don't care that we're going to kill women, children. I don't care. And I said, but that makes us no better than the people who did this. And what drew me to this song was that I needed something that said, no, we are better. And these are the reasons why. These are the things that make us better, that make us something different from some monster who would hijack a plane and fly it into a building. Robeson was probably the most prominent black man of his time. He was incredibly talented as a writer, singer, actor, and his belief that we all could be better than we were and that we all needed to live up to the promise of America eventually got him reviled, literally got him stoned. And to hear Robeson, with the conviction that he brings to this song, standing there and delivering these lyrics and his faith in what America can be, that I find inspiring.
A house that we call freedom, the home of liberty, but especially the people, that's America.
Rob Astick lives in Salem, Massachusetts. Listeners, what music are you listening to these days? What songs or albums or artists are you turning to that help you understand our world? What music is moving you and why? We'd love to hear about it and maybe hear you on a future program. It all starts with an email or a letter from you. Tell us about the music that you're finding hope in, release, solace, or good sense these days. Email us at onpoint@wbur.org or drop us a line at onpointwbur.org. 890 Commonwealth Avenue, Boston, Massachusetts, 02215. That's On Point WBUR at 890 Commonwealth Ave, Boston, Mass, 02215. We'd love to hear from you. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
America to me, a name, a map of a flag.
This